and ate some stale horse bread. Then they went out. There was some bread left over, and Jack hoped that today they would leave it behind. But he was disappointed. Alfred took it with him, as usual. Alfred worked all day on the site with Tom. Jack and his mother sometimes went into the forest for the day. Mother would set traps while Jack went after duck with his slingshot. Whatever they caught, they would sell to villagers, or to the cellarer, Cuthbert. This was their only source of cash, since Tom was not being paid. With the money, they bought cloth or leather or tallow, and on the days when they did not go into the forest, Mother would make shoes, undershirts, candles, or a cap, while Jack and Martha played with the village children. On Sundays, after the service, Tom and Mother liked to sit by the fire, talking. Sometimes they would start kissing, and Tom would put his hand inside Mother's robe, and then they would send the children out for a while and bar the door. This was the worst time of the entire week, for Alfred would be bad-tempered and would persecute the younger ones. Today was an ordinary day, however, and Alfred would be busy from dawn to dusk. Jack got up and went outside. It was cold, but dry. Martha came out a few moments later. The cathedral ruins were already aswarm with workers carrying stones, shoveling rubble, building wooden supports for unsteady walls, and demolishing those which were too far gone to save. There was general agreement among the villagers and monks that the fire had been started by the devil, and for long periods Jack actually forgot that he had started it himself. When he remembered, he would be brought up with a start, and then he would feel extraordinarily pleased with himself. He had taken a terrible risk, but he had got away with it, and he had saved the family from starvation. The monks had their breakfast first, and the lay workers got nothing until the monks went into chapter. It was an awfully long wait for Martha and Jack. Jack always woke up hungry, and the cold morning air increased his appetite. "Let's go to the kitchen courtyard," Jack said. The kitchen hands might give them some scraps. Martha agreed readily. She thought Jack was wonderful, and would go along with anything he suggested. When they got to the kitchen area, they found that Brother Bernard, who was in charge of the bakehouse, was making bread today. Because his helpers were all working on the site, he was carrying firewood for himself. He was a young man, but rather fat, and he was puffing and sweating under a load of logs. "We'll fetch you wood, brother," Jack offered. Bernard dumped the load beside his oven and handed Jack the broad, flat basket. "There's good children," he panted. "God will bless you." Jack took the basket, and the two of them ran to the firewood pile behind the kitchen. They loaded the basket with logs, then carried the heavy load between them. When they got back, the oven was already hot, and Bernard emptied their basket directly onto the fire and sent them back for more. Jack's arms ached, but his stomach hurt more, and he hurried to load the basket again. The second time they returned, Bernard was putting tiny loaves of dough on a tray. "Fetch me one more basket, and you shall have hot buns," he said. Jack's mouth watered. They filled the basket extra high the third time, and staggered back, each holding one handle. As they approached the courtyard, they met Alfred, walking with a bucket, presumably on his way to fetch water from the channel that ran from the millpond across the green, before disappearing underground by the brewery. Alfred hated Jack even more, since Jack had put the dead bird in Alfred's beer. Normally, Jack would casually turn and walk the other way when he saw Alfred. Now he wondered whether to drop the basket and run. But that would look cowardly, and besides, he could smell the fragrance of new bread from the bakehouse, and he was ravenous. So he pressed on, with his heart in his mouth. Alfred laughed at them, struggling under a weight he could easily have carried alone. They gave him a wide berth, but he took a couple of steps toward them and gave Jack a shove, knocking him off his feet. Jack fell hard on his bottom, jarring his spine painfully. He dropped his side of the basket, and all the firewood tipped out onto the ground. Tears welled up in his eyes, caused by rage rather than pain. It was so unfair that Alfred should be able to do that without provocation and get away with it. Jack got up and patiently put the wood back into the basket, pretending for Martha's benefit not to care. They picked up the basket again and continued on to the bakehouse. There they had their reward. The tray of buns was cooling on a stone shelf. When they came in, Bernard took one, stuffed it in his mouth, and said, "They're all right.
Help yourselves. But careful. They're hot.
Jack and Martha each took a bun. Jack bit into his tentatively, afraid of burning his mouth. But it was so delicious that he ate it all in a moment. He looked at the remaining buns. There were 9 left. He glanced up at Brother Bernard, who was grinning at him.
I know what you want, the monk said. Go on, take the lot.
Jack lifted the skirt of his cloak and wrapped the rest of the buns in it.
We'll take them to Mother, he said to Martha.
There's a good boy you are, Bernard said. Off you go, then.
Thank you, brother,
Jack said. They left the bakery and headed for the guest house. Jack was thrilled. Mother would be pleased with him for providing such a treat. He was tempted to eat another bun before he handed them over, but he resisted the temptation. It would be so nice to give her such a lot. As they were crossing the green, they met Alfred again. He had evidently filled his bucket, returned to the site, and emptied it, and he was now coming back for a refill. Jack decided to look nonchalant and hope that Alfred would ignore him. But the way he was carrying the buns, wrapped in the skirt of his cloak, was too obvious to conceal, and once again Alfred turned toward them. Jack would have given him a bun willingly, but he knew Alfred would take them all if he got the chance. Jack broke into a run. Alfred gave chase and soon caught up with him. Alfred stuck out one long leg and tripped Jack, and Jack went flying. The hot buns scattered all over the ground. Alfred picked one up, wiped a smear of mud off it, and popped it into his mouth. His eyes widened with surprise.
New bread, he said.
He began to pick up the others. Jack scrambled to his feet and tried to grab one of the fallen buns, but Alfred hit him a hefty swipe with the flat of his hand, knocking him down again. Alfred quickly scooped up the rest of the buns and walked off, munching. Jack burst into tears. Martha looked sympathetic, but Jack did not want sympathy. He was suffering from humiliation as much as anything else. He walked off, and when Martha followed, he turned on her and said, "Go away." She looked hurt, but she stopped and let him go. He walked toward the ruins, drying his tears on his sleeve. There was murder in his heart. I destroyed the cathedral, he thought. I could kill Alfred. Around the ruins there was a good deal of sweeping and tidying this morning. Some ecclesiastical dignitary was coming to inspect the damage, Jack recalled. It was Alfred's physical superiority that was so maddening. He could do anything he liked just because he was so big. Jack walked around for a while, seething, wishing Alfred had been in the church when all these stones fell. Eventually he saw Alfred again. He was in the north transept, shoveling stone chips into a cart, and he was grey with dust. Near the cart was a roof timber that had survived almost undamaged, merely singed and blackened with soot. Jack rubbed the surface of the beam with a finger. It left a whitish line. Inspired, Jack wrote in the soot, "Alfred is a pig." Some of the labourers noticed. They were surprised Jack could write. One young man said, "What does it say?" "Ask Alfred," Jack replied. Alfred peered at the writing and frowned in annoyance. He could read his own name, Jack knew, but not the rest. He was riled. He knew he was being insulted, but he did not know what had been said, and that was humiliating in itself. He looked rather foolish. Jack's anger was a little soothed. Alfred might be bigger, but Jack was smarter. Still, nobody knew what the word said. Then a novice monk walked past, read the writing, and smiled. "Who's Alfred?" he said. "Him," said Jack with a jerk of the thumb. Alfred looked angrier, but he still did not know what to do, so he leaned on his shovel, looking stupid. The novice laughed. "A pig, eh? What's he digging for? Acorns?" he said. "Must be," said Jack, delighted to have an ally. Alfred dropped his shovel and made a grab for Jack. Jack was ready for him, and went off like an arrow from a bow. The novice stuck out a foot to trip Jack, as if to be even-handedly nasty to both sides, but Jack nimbly leaped over it. He raced along what had been the chancel, dodging around piles of rubble and jumping over fallen roof timbers. He could hear the heavy steps and grunting breath of Alfred right behind him, and fear lent him speed. A moment later he realized he had run the wrong way. There was no way out of that end of the cathedral. He had made a mistake. He realized with a sinking heart that he was going to get hurt. The upper half of the east end had fallen in, and the stones were piled up against what remained of the wall. Having nowhere else to go, Jack scrambled up the pile with Alfred hot on his heels. He reached the top and saw in front of him a sheer drop of about 15 feet. He teetered fearfully on the edge. It was too far to jump without hurting himself. Alfred made a grab for his ankle. Jack lost his balance. For a moment he stood with one foot on the wall and the other in the air, windmilling his arms in an attempt to regain his footing. Alfred kept hold of his ankle. Jack felt himself falling inexorably the wrong way. Alfred held on a moment longer, unbalancing Jack further, then let go. Jack fell through the air, unable to right himself, and he heard himself scream. He landed on his left side. The impact was terrific. By an unlucky chance, his face hit a stone. Everything went black for a moment. When he opened his eyes, Alfred was standing over him. He must have clambered down the wall somehow, and beside him was one of the older monks. Jack recognized the monk. It was Remigius, the sub-prior. Remigius caught his eye and said, "Get up, lad." Jack was not sure he could. He could not move his left arm. The left side of his face was numb. He sat upright. He had thought he was going to die, and it surprised him to be able to move at all. Using his right arm to push himself up, he struggled painfully to his feet, putting most of his weight on his right leg. As the numbness went, he began to hurt. Remigius took him by the left arm. Jack cried out in pain. Remigius ignored him and grabbed Alfred's ear. He would probably issue some dire punishment to both of them, Jack thought. Jack hurt too much to care. Remigius spoke to Alfred. "Now, my lad, why are you trying to kill your brother?"
"He's not my brother," Alfred said.
Remigius's expression changed.
"Not your brother," he said. "Don't you have the same mother and father?"
"She's not my mother," Alfred said. "My mother's dead."
A crafty look came over Remigius's face.
"When did your mother die?"
"At Christmas. Last Christmas. Yes."
Despite his pain, Jack could see that Remigius was intensely interested in this for some reason. The monk's voice quivered with suppressed excitement as he said,
"So your father has only lately met this boy's mother?"
"Yes."
"And since they have been together, have they been to see a priest to have their union solemnized?"
I don't know."
Alfred did not understand the words being used, Jack could tell. For that matter, neither did Jack. Remigius said impatiently,
"Well, have they had a wedding?"
"No."
"I see."
Remigius looked pleased about this, although Jack would have thought he would be cross. There was a rather satisfied look on the monk's face. He was silent and thoughtful for a moment. Then he seemed to remember the two boys.
"Well, if you want to stay in the priory and eat the monk's bread, don't fight, even if you aren't brothers. We men of God must not see bloodshed. That is one of the reasons we live a life of withdrawal from the world."
With that little speech, Remigius released them both and turned away, and at last Jack could run to his mother. It had taken 3 weeks, not two, but Tom had got the crypt ready for use as a makeshift church, and today the bishop-elect was coming to hold the first service in it. The cloisters had been cleared of rubble, and Tom had repaired the damaged parts. Cloisters were simple structures, just covered walkways, and the work had been easy. Most of the rest of the church was just heaps of ruins, and some of the walls that were still standing were in danger of falling. But Tom had cleared a passage from the cloisters through what had been the south transept to the crypt stairs. Tom looked around him. The crypt was a good size, about 50 feet square, plenty big enough for the monks' services. It was a rather dark room, with heavy pillars and a low vaulted ceiling, but it was stoutly constructed, which was why it had survived the fire. They had brought in a trestle table to be used as an altar, and the benches from the refectory would serve as stalls for the monks. When the sacrist brought in his embroidered altar cloths and jeweled candlesticks, it would look just fine. With the resumption of services, Tom's workforce would shrink. Most of the monks would return to their lives of worship, and many of those who did labour would resume their agricultural or administrative tasks. Tom would still have about half the priory servants as labourers, however. Prior Philip had taken a tough line with them. He felt there had been too many of them, and if any were unwilling to transfer from their duties as grooms or kitchen hands, he was quite ready to dismiss them. A few had gone, but most remained. The priory already owed Tom 3 weeks' wages. At the full master builder's rate of fourpence a day, that came to 72 pence. As each day went by, the debt mounted, and it would become more and more difficult for Prior Philip to pay Tom off. After about half a year, Tom would ask the prior to start paying him. By then he would be owed 2.5 pounds of silver, which Philip would have to find before he could dismiss Tom. The debt made Tom feel secure. There was even a chance, he hardly dared to think it, that this job would last him the rest of his life. It was, after all, a cathedral church, and if the powers that be were to decide to commission a prestigious new building, and if they could find the money to pay for it, it could be the largest construction project in the kingdom, employing dozens of masons for several decades. This was too much to hope for, really. Talking to the monks and the villagers, Tom had learned that Kingsbridge had never been an important cathedral. Tucked away in a quiet village, it had had a series of unambitious bishops, and was clearly undergoing a slow decline. The priory was undistinguished and penniless. Some monasteries attracted the attention of kings and archbishops by their lavish hospitality, their excellent schools, their great libraries, the researches of their philosopher monks, or the erudition of their priors and abbots. But Kingsbridge had none of those marks. The likelihood was that Prior Philip would build a small church, constructed simply and fitted out modestly, and that might take no more than 10 years. However, that suited Tom perfectly. He had realized, even before the fire-blackened ruins were cold, that this was his chance to build his own cathedral. Prior Philip was already convinced that God had sent Tom to Kingsbridge. Tom knew he had won Philip's trust by the efficient way he had begun the process of clearing up and made the priory viable again. When the moment was right, he would begin talking to Philip about designs for the new building. If he handled the situation carefully, there was every chance that Philip would ask him to draw the designs. The fact that the new church was likely to be fairly modest made it more probable that the planning might be entrusted to Tom, rather than to a master with more experience of cathedral building. Tom's hopes were high. The bell rang for chapter. This was also the sign that the lay workers should go in for breakfast. Tom left the crypt and headed for the refectory. On his way he was confronted by Ellen. She stood aggressively in front of him as if to bar his way, and there was an odd look in her eye. Martha and Jack were with her. Jack looked terrible. One eye was closed, the left side of his face was bruised and swollen, and he leaned on his right leg, as if his left could not take any weight. Tom felt sorry for the little chap. "What happened to you?" he said. Ellen said, "Alfred did this." Tom groaned inwardly. For a moment he felt ashamed of Alfred, who was so much bigger than Jack. But Jack was no angel. Perhaps Alfred had been provoked. Tom looked around for his son and caught sight of him walking toward the refectory, covered with dust. "Alfred!" he bellowed. "Come here!" Alfred turned around, saw the family group, and approached slowly, looking guilty. Tom said to him, "Did you do this?"
"He fell off a wall," Alfred said sullenly. "Did you push him?"
"I was chasing him."
"Who started it?"
"Jack called me a name."
Jack, speaking through swollen lips, said,
"I called him a pig because he took our bread."
"Bread?" said Tom. "Where did you get bread before breakfast?"
"Bernard Baker gave it to us. We fetched firewood for him."
"You should have shared it with Alfred," Tom said.
"I would have,"
Alfred said.
"Then why did you run away?"
"I was taking it home to Mother," Jack protested. "Then Alfred ate it all."
14 years of raising children had taught Tom that there was no prospect of discovering the rights and wrongs of a childish quarrel. "Go to breakfast, all three of you, and if there's any more fighting today, you, Alfred, will end up with a face like Jack's, and I'll be the one who does it to you. Now clear off." The children went away. Tom and Ellen followed at a slower pace. After a moment, Ellen said, "Is that all you're going to say?" Tom glanced at her. She was still angry, but there was nothing he could do about it. He shrugged. "As usual, both parties are guilty."
"Tom, how can you say that?
One's as bad as the other.
Alfred took their bread. Jack called him a pig. That doesn't draw blood."
Tom shook his head.
"Boys always fight. You could spend your whole life adjudicating their quarrels. Best to leave them to it."
"That won't do, Tom," she said in a dangerous tone. "Look at Jack's face, then look at Alfred's. That's not the result of a childish fight. That's a vicious attack by a grown man on a small boy."
Tom resented her attitude. Alfred was not perfect, he knew, but neither was Jack. Tom did not want Jack to become the pampered favorite in this family.
"Alfred's not a grown man, he's 14 years old, but he is working. He's making a contribution to the support of the family, and Jack isn't. Jack plays all day like a child. In my book, that means Jack ought to show Alfred respect. He does no such thing, as you will have noticed."
"I don't care," Ellen flared. "You can say what you like, but my son is badly bruised and might have been seriously injured, and I will not allow it."
She began to cry. In a quieter voice, but still angry, she said, "He's my child, and I can't bear to see him like that." Tom sympathized with her, and he was tempted to comfort her, but he was afraid to give in. He had a feeling that this conversation might be a turning point. Living with his mother and no one else, Jack had always been overprotected. Tom did not want to concede that Jack ought to be cushioned against the normal knocks of everyday life. That would set a precedent that could cause endless trouble in years to come. Tom knew, in truth, that Alfred had gone too far this time, and he was secretly resolved to make the boy leave Jack alone. But it would be a bad thing to say so. "Beatings are a part of life," he said to Ellen. "Jack must learn to take them or avoid them. I can't spend my life protecting him."
"You could protect him from that bullying son of yours."
Tom winced. He hated to hear her call Alfred a bully.
"I might, but I shan't," he said angrily. "Jack must learn to protect himself."
"Oh, go to hell,"
Ellen said, and she turned and walked away. Tom entered the refectory. The wooden hut where the lay workers normally ate had been damaged by the fall of the southwest tower, so they took their meals in the refectory after the monks had finished and gone. Tom sat apart from everyone else, feeling unsociable. A kitchen hand brought him a jug of ale and some slices of bread in a basket. He dipped a piece of bread in the ale to soften it and began to eat. Alfred was a big lad with too much energy, Tom thought fondly. He sighed into his beer. The boy was something of a bully, Tom knew in his heart, but he would calm down in time. Meanwhile, Tom was not going to make his own children give special treatment to a newcomer. They had had too much to put up with already. They had lost their mother. They had been forced to tramp the roads. They had come near to starving to death. He was not going to impose any more burdens on them if he could help it. They were due for a little indulgence. Jack would just have to keep out of Alfred's way. It would not kill him. A disagreement with Ellen always left Tom heavy-hearted. They had quarreled several times, usually about the children, although this was their worst dispute so far. When she was hard-faced and hostile, he could not remember what it had been like just a little while earlier to feel passionately in love with her. She seemed like an angry stranger who had intruded into his peaceful life. He had never had such furious, bitter quarrels with his first wife. Looking back, it seemed to him that he and Agnes had agreed about everything important, and that when they disagreed it had not made them angry. That was how it should be between man and wife, and Ellen would have to realize that she could not be part of a family and yet have all her own way. Even when Ellen was at her most infuriating, he never quite wished that she would go away. But all the same, he often thought of Agnes with regret. Agnes had been with him for most of his adult life, and now he had a constant sense of there being something missing. While she was alive, he had never thought that he was particularly fortunate to have her, nor had he felt thankful for her. But now that she was dead, he missed her, and he felt ashamed that he had taken her for granted. At quiet moments in the day, when all his labourers had their instructions and were busy about the site, and Tom was able to get down to a skilled task, rebuilding a bit of wall in the cloisters or repairing a pillar in the crypt, he sometimes held imaginary conversations with Agnes. Mostly he told her about Jonathan, their baby son. Tom saw the child most days, being fed in the kitchen, or walked in the cloisters, or put to bed in the monk's dormitory. He seemed perfectly healthy and happy, and no one but Ellen knew or even suspected that Tom had a special interest in him. Tom also talked to Agnes about Alfred and Prior Philip and even Ellen, explaining his feelings about them, just as he would have done, except in the case of Ellen, if Agnes had been alive. He told her of his practical plans for the future, too, his hope that he would be employed here for years to come, and his dream of designing and building the new cathedral himself. In his head he heard her replies and questions. She was, at different times, pleased, encouraging, fascinated, suspicious, or disapproving. Sometimes he felt she was right, sometimes wrong. If he had told anyone of these conversations, they would have said he was communing with a ghost, and there would have been a flurry of priests and holy water and exorcism. But he knew there was nothing supernatural about what was happening. It was just that he knew her so well that he could imagine how she would feel and what she would say in just about any situation. She came into his mind unbidden at odd times. When he peeled a pear with his eating knife for little Martha, he remembered how Agnes had always laughed at him because he would take pains to remove the peel in one continuous strip. Whenever he had to write something, he would think of her, for she had taught him everything she had learned from her father, the priest. And he would remember her teaching him how to trim a quill, or how to spell cementarius, the Latin word for mason. As he washed his face on Sundays, he would rub soap into his beard, and recall how, when they were young, she had taught him that washing his beard would keep his face free from lice and boils. Never a day went by without some such little incident bringing her vividly to mind. He knew he was lucky to have Ellen. There was no danger of his taking her for granted. She was unique. There was something abnormal about her, and it was that abnormal something that made her magnetic. He was grateful to her for consoling him in his grief the morning after Agnes died. But sometimes he wished he had met her a few days, instead of a few hours, after he had buried his wife, just so that he would have had time to be heartbroken alone. He would not have observed a period of mourning, that was for lords and monks, not ordinary folk, but he would have had time to become accustomed to the absence of Agnes before he started to get used to living with Ellen. Such thoughts had not occurred to him during the early days, when the threat of starvation had combined with the sexual excitement of Ellen to produce a kind of hysterical end-of-the-world elation. But since he had found work and security, he had begun to feel pangs of regret. And sometimes it seemed that when he thought like this about Agnes, he was not only missing her, but mourning the passing of his own youth. Never again would he be as naive, as aggressive, as hungry or as strong as he had been when he had first fallen in love with Agnes. He finished his bread and left the refectory ahead of the others. He went into the cloisters. He was pleased with his work here. It was now hard to imagine that the quadrangle had been buried under a mass of rubble 3 weeks earlier. The only remaining signs of the catastrophe were some cracked paving stones for which he had been unable to find replacements. There was a lot of dust about, though. He would have the cloisters swept again, and then sprinkled with water. He walked through the ruined church. In the north transept, he saw a blackened beam with words written in the soot. Tom read it slowly. It said, "Alfred is a pig." So that was what had infuriated Alfred. Quite a lot of the wood from the roof had not burned to ashes, and there were blackened beams like this lying all around. Tom decided he would detail a group of workers to collect all the timber and take it to the firewood store. "Make the site look tidy," Agnes would say, when someone important was coming to visit. "You want them to feel glad that Tom's in charge." "Yes, dear," Tom thought, and he smiled to himself as he went about his work. Walleran Bygod's party was sighted a mile or so away across the fields. There were three of them, riding quite hard. Walleran himself was in the lead on a black horse, his black cloak flying behind. Philip and the senior monastic officials waited by the stable to welcome them. Philip was not sure how to treat Walleran. Walleran had deceived him indisputably by not telling him that the bishop was dead, but when the truth came out, Walleran had not appeared in the least ashamed, and Philip had not known what to say to him. He still did not know, but he suspected that there was nothing to be gained by complaining. Anyway, that whole episode had been overshadowed by the catastrophe of the fire. Philip would just be extremely wary of Walleran in the future. Walleran's horse was a stallion, skittish and excitable, despite having been ridden several miles. He held its head down hard as he walked it to the stable. Philip disapproved. There was no need for a clergyman to cut a dash on horseback, and most men of God chose quieter mounts. Walleran swung off the horse with a fluid motion and gave the reins to a stable hand. Philip greeted him formally. Walleran turned and surveyed the ruins. A bleak look came into his eyes, and he said, "This was an expensive fire, Philip." He seemed genuinely distressed, somewhat to Philip's surprise. Before Philip could reply, Remigius spoke up. "The devil's work, my lord bishop," he said. "Was it now?" said Walleran. "In my experience, the devil is usually assisted in such work by monks who light fires in church to take the chill off matins, or carelessly leave burning candles in the bell tower." Philip was amused to see Remigius crushed, but he could not let Walleran's insinuations pass. "I've held an investigation into possible causes of the conflagration," he said. "No one lit a fire in the church that night. I can be sure because I was present at matins myself, and no one had been up in the roof for months beforehand." "So what is your explanation?" "Lightning?" Walleran said skeptically. Philip shook his head. "There was no storm. The fire seems to have started in the vicinity of the crossing. We did leave a candle burning on the altar after the service, as usual. It's possible that the altar cloth caught fire and a spark was taken by an updraft to the wooden ceiling, which was very old and dry." Philip shrugged. "It's not a very satisfactory explanation, but it's the best we have." Walleran nodded. "Let's have a closer look at the damage." They moved off toward the church. Walleran's two companions were a man-at-arms and a young priest. The man-at-arms stayed behind to see to the horse. The priest accompanied Walleran and was introduced to Philip as Dean Baldwin. As they all crossed the green to the church, Remigius put a hand on Walleran's arm, stopping him, and said, "The guest house is undamaged, as you can see." Everyone stopped and turned around. Philip wondered irritably what Remigius was thinking of. If the guest house was undamaged, why make everyone stop and look at it? The builder's wife was walking up from the kitchens, and they all watched her enter the house. Philip glanced at Walleran. He was looking slightly shocked. Philip remembered the moment back at the bishop's palace when Walleran had seen the builder's wife and had looked almost frightened. What was it about that woman? Walleran gave Remigius a swift look and an almost imperceptible nod. Then he turned to Philip and said, "Who is living there?" Philip was quite sure Walleran had recognized her, but he said, "A master builder and his family." Walleran nodded, and they all moved on. Philip knew now why Remigius had called attention to the guest house. He had wanted to make sure Walleran saw the woman. Philip made up his mind to question her at the earliest opportunity. They went into the ruins. A group of 7 or 8 men, made up of monks and priory servants in about equal numbers, was lifting a half-burned roof beam under the supervision of Tom. The whole site looked busy but tidy. Philip felt that the air of bustling efficiency did him credit, although Tom was responsible. Tom came to meet them. He towered over everyone else. Philip said to Walleran, "This is our master builder, Tom. He's managed to make the cloisters and the crypt usable again already. We're very grateful to him."
"I remember you," Walleran said to Tom. "You came to me just after Christmas. I didn't have any work for you."
"That's right,"
Tom said in his deep, dusty voice. Perhaps God was saving me to help Prior Philip in his time of trouble.
A theological builder,
Walleran mocked. Tom reddened faintly under his dusty skin. Philip thought that Walleran must have a strong nerve to make fun of such a big man, even though Walleran was a bishop and Tom only a mason.
What is your next step here? Walleran asked.
We must make the place safe by knocking down the remaining walls before they fall on someone, Tom replied meekly enough. Then we should clear the site ready for the building of the new church. As soon as possible we should find tall trees for the timbers of the new roof. The longer the wood is seasoned, the better the roof will be.
Philip said hastily, Before we start felling trees, we must find the money to pay for them.
We'll speak about that later, Walleran said enigmatically.
That remark intrigued Philip. He hoped Walleran had a scheme for raising the money to build the new church. If the priory had to rely on its own resources, it would not be able to begin for many years. Philip had been agonizing over this for the past 3 weeks, and he still had not come up with a solution. He led the group along the path that had been cleared through the rubble to the cloisters. One glance was sufficient for Walleran to see that this area had been set to rights. They moved on from there and crossed the green to the prior's house in the southeast corner of the close. Once inside, Walleran took off his cloak and sat down, holding his pale hands out to the fire. Brother Milius, the kitchener, served hot, spiced wine in small wooden bowls. Walleran sipped his and said to Philip,
Has it occurred to you that Tom Builder might have started the fire to provide himself with work?
Yes, it has, Philip said, but I don't think he did. He would have had to get inside the church, which was securely locked up.
He might have gone in during the day and hidden himself away.
Then he would have been unable to get out after he started the fire. He shook his head. This was not the real reason he was sure Tom was innocent. Anyway, I don't believe him capable of such a thing. He's an intelligent man, much more so than you might think at first, but he's not sly. If he were guilty, I think I would have seen it in his face, when I looked him in the eye and asked him how he thought the fire might have started.
Somewhat to Philip's surprise, Walleran agreed immediately.
I believe you're right, he said. I can't see him setting fire to a church somehow. He's just not the type.
We may never know for sure how the fire started, Philip said. But we must face the problem of raising the money to build a new church.
I don't know.
Yes,
Walleran interrupted, and held up a hand to stop Philip. He turned to the others in the room.
I must speak to Prior Philip alone, he said. The rest of you may leave us.
Philip was intrigued. He could not imagine why Walleran had to speak to him alone about this.
Remigius said, Before we go, Lord Bishop, there is something the brothers have asked me to say to you.
Philip thought, What now? Walleran raised a skeptical eyebrow.
And why should they ask you, rather than your prior, to raise a matter with me?
Because Prior Philip is deaf to their complaint.
Philip was angry and mystified. There had been no complaint. Remigius was just trying to embarrass Philip by creating a scene in front of the bishop-elect. Philip caught an inquiring glance from Walleran. He shrugged and tried to look unconcerned.
I can't wait to hear what the complaint is, he said. Please go ahead, Brother Remigius, if you're quite sure the matter is important enough to require the attention of the bishop.
Remigius said, There is a woman living in the priory.
Not that again, Philip said with exasperation. She's the builder's wife and she lives in the guest house.
She's a witch! Said Remigius.
Philip wondered why Remigius was doing this. Remigius had mounted this particular horse once already, and it would not run. The point was moot, but the prior was the authority, and Walleran was bound to support Philip, unless he wanted to be called in every time Remigius disagreed with his superior. Wearily, Philip said, She's not a witch.
Have you interrogated the woman? Remigius demanded.
Philip recalled that he had promised to question her. He had never done so. He had seen the husband and told him to tell her to be circumspect, but he had not actually spoken to the woman himself. That was a pity, for it permitted Remigius to score a point, but it was not much of a point.
and Philip felt sure it would not cause Walleran to take Remigius's side.
"I haven't interrogated her," Philip admitted, "but there is no evidence of witchcraft, and the whole family is perfectly honest and Christian."
"She's a witch and a fornicator," Remigius said, flushing with righteous indignation.
"What?" Philip exploded. "With whom does she fornicate?"
"With the builder."
"He's her husband, you fool!"
"No, he's not," Remigius said triumphantly. "They're not married, and they've only known one another a month." Philip was bowled over. He had never suspected this. Remigius had taken him completely by surprise. If Remigius was telling the truth, the woman was a fornicator, technically. It was a type of fornication that was normally overlooked, for many couples did not get around to having their union blessed by a priest until they had been together for a while, often until the first child was conceived. Indeed, in very poor or remote parts of the country, couples often lived as man and wife for decades and brought up children, and then startled a visiting priest by asking him to solemnize their marriage around the time their grandchildren were being born. However, it was one thing for a parish priest to be indulgent among poor peasants on the outskirts of Christendom, and quite another when an important employee of a priory was committing the same act within the precincts of the monastery.
"What makes you think they aren't married?" Philip said skeptically, although he felt sure Remigius would have checked the facts before speaking up in front of Walleran.
"I found the sons fighting, and they told me they aren't brothers. Then the whole story came out." Philip was disappointed with Tom. Fornication was a common enough sin, but it was particularly abhorrent to monks, who forsook all carnality. How could Tom do this? He should have known it was hateful to Philip. Philip felt angrier with Tom than he did with Remigius. But Remigius had been sneaky. Philip asked him, "Why did you not tell me, your prior, about this?"
"It was only this morning that I heard it."
Philip sat back in his seat, defeated. Remigius had caught him out. Philip looked foolish. This was Remigius's revenge for his defeat in the election. Philip looked at Walleran. The complaint had been made to Walleran. Now Walleran could pronounce judgment. Walleran did not hesitate.
"The case is clear enough," he said. "The woman must confess her sin and do public penance for it. She must leave the priory and live in chastity apart from the builder for a year. Then they may be married."
A year apart was a harsh sentence. Philip felt she deserved it for defiling the monastery, but he was anxious about how she would receive it.
"She may not submit to your judgment," he said.
Walleran shrugged.
"Then she will burn in hell.
If she leaves Kingsbridge, I'm afraid Tom may go with her.
There are other builders,
of course." Philip would be sorry to lose Tom, but he could tell from Walleran's expression that Walleran would not mind if Tom and his woman were to leave Kingsbridge and never come back, and he wondered again why she was so important. Walleran said, "Now clear out, all of you, and let me speak to your prior."
"Just a minute," Philip said sharply.
It was his house, and they were his monks, after all. He would summon and dismiss them, not Walleran.
"I will speak to the builder myself about this matter. None of you is to mention it to anyone, do you hear? There'll be a harsh punishment for you if you disobey me over this. Is that clear, Remigius?"
"Yes," said Remigius. Philip looked inquiringly at Remigius and said nothing. There was a pregnant silence.
"Yes, father," Remigius said at last.
"All right, off you go." Remigius, Andrew, Milius, Cuthbert, and Dean Baldwin all trooped out. Walleran helped himself to a little more hot wine and stretched his feet out to the fire.
"Women always cause trouble," he said. "When there's a mare in heat in the stables, all the stallions start nipping the grooms, kicking their stalls, and generally causing trouble. Even the geldings start to misbehave. Monks are like geldings. Physical passion is denied them, but they can still smell cunt."
Philip was embarrassed. There was no need for such explicit talk, he felt. He looked at his hands.
"What about rebuilding the church?" he said.
"Yes. You must have heard that business you came to see me about, Earl Bartholomew and the conspiracy against King Stephen, turned out well for us."
"Yes."
It seemed a long time ago that Philip had gone to the bishop's palace in fear and trembling, to tell of the plot against the king whom the church had chosen. I heard that Percy Hamley attacked the Earl's castle and took him prisoner. That's right. Bartholomew is now in a dungeon at Winchester waiting to hear his fate, Walleran said with satisfaction. And Earl Robert of Gloucester? He was the more powerful conspirator, and therefore gets the lighter punishment. In fact, no punishment at all. He has pledged allegiance to King Stephen, and his part in the plot has been overlooked. But what has that got to do with our cathedral? Walleran stood up and went to the window. When he looked out at the ruined church, there was real sadness in his eyes, and Philip realized that there was a core of genuine piety in Walleran for all his worldly ways. Our part in the defeat of Bartholomew puts King Stephen in our debt. Before too long, you and I will go and see him. See the king? Philip said. He was a little intimidated by the prospect. He will ask us what we want as our reward. Philip saw what Walleran was getting at, and he was thrilled to the core. And we'll tell him. Walleran turned back from the window and looked at Philip, and his eyes looked like black jewels glittering with ambition. We'll tell him we want a new cathedral for Kingsbridge, he said. Tom knew Ellen was going to hit the roof. She was already angry about what had happened to Jack. Tom needed to soothe her, but the news of her penance was going to inflame her. He wished he could postpone telling her for a day or two to give her time to cool off. But he could not, for Prior Philip had said she must be off the premises by nightfall. He had to tell her immediately, and since it was midday when Philip told Tom, Tom told Ellen at dinner. They went into the refectory with the other priory employees when the monks had finished their dinner and gone. The tables were crowded, but Tom thought that might not be a bad thing. The presence of other people might restrain her a little, he thought. He was wrong about that, he soon learned. He tried to break the news gradually. First, he said, they know we're not married. Who told them? She said angrily. Some troublemaker? Alfred, don't blame him. That sly monk Remigius got it out of him. Anyway, we never told the children to keep it secret. I don't blame the boy, she said more calmly. So what do they say? He leaned across the table and spoke in a low voice. They say you're a fornicator, he said, hoping no one else would hear. A fornicator? She said loudly. What about you? Don't these monks know that it takes two to fornicate? The people sitting nearby started to laugh. Hush, Tom said. They say we have to get married. She looked at him hard. If that was all, you wouldn't be looking so hangdog, Tom Builder. Tell me the rest. They want you to confess your sin. Hypocritical perverts, she said disgustedly. They spend all night up one another's arseholes, and then they have the nerve to call what we're doing a sin. There was more laughter at that. People stopped their own conversations to listen to Ellen. Just talk quietly, Tom pleaded. I suppose they want me to do penance, too. Humiliation is all part of it. What do they want me to do? Come on, tell the truth. You can't lie to a witch. Don't say that, Tom hissed. It makes things worse.
Then tell me.
We have to live apart for a year, and you have to remain chaste.
Piss on that!
Ellen shouted. Now everyone was looking.
Piss on you, Tom Builder, she said.
She realized she had an audience.
Piss on all of you, too, she said.
Most people grinned. It was hard to take offense, perhaps because she looked so lovely with her face flushed red and her golden eyes wide. She stood up.
Piss on Kingsbridge Priory!
She jumped up onto the table, and there was a burst of applause. She walked along the board. The diners snatched their bowls of soup and mugs of ale out of her way and sat back, laughing.
Piss on the prior, she said. Piss on the sub-prior and the sacrist and the cantor and the treasurer and all their deeds and charters and their chests full of silver pennies.
She reached the end of the table. Beyond it was another smaller table where someone would sit and read aloud during the monk's dinner. There was an open book on the table. Ellen jumped from the dining table to the reading table. Suddenly, Tom knew what she was going to do.
Alan, he called, don't, please.
Piss on the rule of Saint Benedict,
she yelled at the top of her voice. Then she hitched up her skirt, bent her knees, and urinated on the open book. The men roared with laughter, banged on the tables, hooted and whistled and cheered. Tom was not sure whether they shared Ellen's contempt for the rule, or they just enjoyed seeing a beautiful woman expose herself. There was something erotic about her shameless vulgarity, but it was also exciting to see someone openly abuse the book that the monks were so tediously solemn about. Whatever the reason, they loved it. She jumped off the table, and amid a thunder of applause ran out of the door. Everyone began to talk at the same time. No one had ever seen anything quite like that before. Tom was horrified and embarrassed. The consequences would be dire, he knew. Yet a part of him was thinking, what a woman. Jack got up after a moment and followed his mother out, with a trace of a grin on his swollen face. Tom looked at Alfred and Martha. Alfred had a bewildered air, but Martha was giggling. Come on, you two, Tom said, and the three of them left the refectory. When they got outside, Ellen was nowhere to be seen. They went across the green to the guest house and found her there. She was sitting in the chair waiting for him. She was wearing her cloak and holding her big leather satchel. She looked cool, calm, and collected. Tom's heart went cold when he saw the bag, but he pretended not to have noticed it. There's going to be hell to pay, he said.
I don't believe in hell, she said.
I hope they'll let you confess and do penance.
I'm not going to confess.
His self-control broke. Ellen,
don't leave.
She looked sad.
Listen, Tom. Before I met you, I had food to eat and a place to live. I was safe and secure and self-sufficient. I needed nobody. Since I've been with you, I've come closer to starvation than at any time in my life. You've got work now, but there's no security in it. The Priory has no money to build a new church, and you could be on the road again next winter.
Philip will raise the money somehow, Tom said. I'm sure he will.
You can't be sure, she said.
You don't believe, Tom said bitterly. Then before he could stop himself, he added, You're just like Agnes. You don't believe in my cathedral.
Oh, Tom, if it was just me, I'd stay, she said sadly. But look at my son.
Tom looked at Jack. His face was purple with bruising. His ear was swollen to twice its normal size. His nostrils were full of dried blood, and he had a broken front tooth. Ellen said,
I was afraid he would grow up like an animal if we stayed in the forest. But if this is the price of teaching him to live with other people, it's too much to pay. So I'm going back to the forest.
Don't say that, Tom said desperately. Let's talk about it. Don't make a rash decision.
It's not rash.
It's not rash, Tom, she said sorrowfully.
I'm so sad that I can't even be angry anymore. I really wanted to be your wife, but not at any cost.
If Alfred had not chased Jack, none of this would have happened, Tom thought. But it was only a boyish scrap, wasn't it? Or was Ellen right when she said Tom had a blind spot about Alfred? Tom began to feel he had been wrong. Perhaps he should have taken a firmer line with Alfred. Boys fighting was one thing, but Jack and Martha were smaller than Alfred. Perhaps he was a bully. But it was too late to change that now.
Stay in the village, Tom said desperately. Wait a while and see what happens.
I don't suppose the monks will let me, now. He realized she was right. The village was owned by the Priory, and all the householders paid rent to the monks, usually in the form of days of work, and the monks could refuse to house anyone they did not like. They could hardly be blamed if they rejected Ellen. She had made her decision, and she had literally pissed on her chances of retracting it.
I'll go with you then, he said.
The monastery owes me 72 pennies already. We'll go on the road again. We survived before.
What about your children?
She said gently. Tom remembered how Martha had cried from hunger. He knew he could not make her go through that again. And there was his baby son, Jonathan, living here with the monks. I don't want to leave him again, Tom thought. I did it once and hated myself for it. But he could not bear the thought of losing Ellen.
Don't tear yourself apart, she said. I won't tramp the roads with you again. That's no solution. We'd be worse off than we are now in every way. I'm going back to the forest, and you're not coming with me. He stared at her. He wanted to believe that she did not mean it, but the look on her face told him she did. He could not think of anything more to say to stop her. He opened his mouth to speak, but no words came. He felt helpless. She was breathing hard, her bosom rising and falling with emotion. He wanted to touch her, but he felt she did not want him to. I may never embrace her again, he thought. It was hard to believe. For weeks he had lain with her every night and touched her as familiarly as he would touch himself, and now suddenly it was forbidden, and she was like a stranger. Don't look so sad, she said. Her eyes were full of tears. I can't help it, he said. I am sad. I'm sorry I've made you so unhappy. Don't be sorry for that. Be sorry that you made me so happy. That's what hurts, woman, that you made me so happy. A sob escaped from her lips. She turned away and left without another word. Jack and Martha went out after her. Alfred hesitated, looking awkward, then followed them. Tom stood staring at the chair she had left. No, he thought, it can't be true. She isn't leaving me. He sat down in the chair. It was still warm from her body, the body he loved so much. He stiffened his face to stop the tears. He knew she would not change her mind now. She never vacillated. She was a person who made a decision and then carried it through. She might regret it eventually, though. He seized on that shred of hope. He knew she loved him. That had not changed. Only last night she had made love frantically, like someone slaking a terrible thirst, and after he was satisfied she had rolled on top of him and carried on, kissing him hungrily, gasping into his beard as she came time and time again, until she was too exhausted with pleasure to go on. And it was not just the fucking that she liked. They enjoyed being together all the time. They talked constantly, much more than he and Agnes had talked, even in the early days. She's going to miss me as much as I'll miss her, he thought. After a while, when her anger has died down, and she has settled into a new routine, she'll hanker for someone to talk to, a hard body to touch, a bearded face to kiss. Then she'll think of me. But she was proud. She might be too proud to come back, even if she wanted to. He sprang out of his chair. He had to tell her what was on his mind. He left the house. She was at the Priory gate saying goodbye to Martha. Tom ran past the stable and caught up with her. She gave him a sad smile. Goodbye, Tom. He took her hands. Will you come back one day? Just to see us. If I know you're not going away forever, that I will see you again sometime, if only for a little while. If I know that, I can bear it. She hesitated. Please. All right, she said. Swear it. I don't believe in oaths. But I do. All right. I swear it. Thank you. He pulled her gently to him. She did not resist him. He hugged her and his control broke. Tears poured down his face. At last she drew away. Reluctantly he let her go. She turned toward the gate. At that moment there was a noise from the stable, the sound of a spirited horse being disobedient, stamping and snorting. Automatically they all looked round. The horse was Walleran Bygod's black stallion, and the bishop was about to mount. His eyes met Ellen's, and he froze. At that moment, she started to sing. Tom did not know the song, although he had heard her sing often. The melody was terribly sad. The words were French, but he could understand them well enough. A lark, caught in a hunter's net, sang sweeter then than ever, as if the falling melody might wing and net dissever. Tom looked from her to the bishop. Walleran was terrified. His mouth was open, his eyes wide, his face as white as death. Tom was astonished. Why did a simple song have the power to scare such a man? At dusk the hunter took his prey, the lark, his freedom never. All birds and men are sure to die, but songs may live forever. Ellen called out, "Goodbye, Walleran Bygod.
I'm leaving Kingsbridge, but I'm not leaving you. I'll be with you in your dreams.
And mine, Tom thought. For a moment, no one moved.